The Taliban spokesman announces the capture of Panjshir province. He also says that a new government will be announced soon. Britain says it's investigating whether or not the chaotic withdrawal of U.S.-led forces from Afghanistan led some war veterans to commit suicides. And six Palestinians escaped from a high-security Israeli prison. Hamas and Islamic Jihad hail it as a brave and heroic act. I'm Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. Starting with Afghanistan, anti-Taliban forces in the Valley of Panjshir say that the struggle with the Taliban and their partners will continue, and that after the Taliban announced that they completely captured the Panjshir area. National Resistance Front says it has been present in the strategic areas of the valley. NRF's leader, Ahmad Massoud, also issued a statement. He slammed the Taliban for violating human rights and targeting women and children. Massoud said that the U.S. and NATO have indirectly equipped the forces of the Taliban, Daesh, and Al-Qaeda with a large number of weapons. He urged the international community to put aside their neutrality and take action against what he called a horrifying tragedy against humanity in Afghanistan. Amin Alami has an update regarding the Taliban claim about a takeover of Panjshir.
According to Taliban spokesman Zabihullah Mujahid, the war in Afghanistan is over because the Taliban are now in full control of the entire country after the collapse of Panjshir into the hands of Taliban. However, despite the Taliban are claiming that we have full control over Panjshir, Mujahid says that an amnesty has already been granted to those who were inside Panjshir and were fighting against the Taliban there. He particularly named the leaders of Resistance Front in Panjshir as those who will be benefited from this amnesty, and called on them, not only on them, but on all those former government officials who have fled the country to return back to Afghanistan. Mujahid insisted that the war has war is over in Afghanistan. That is why he called on all the people of Afghanistan and political players inside and abroad to come together and reconstruct their own homeland.
Iran says that any type of foreign intervention in Afghanistan will result in a defeat. Foreign Ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh says that Afghan history indicates the fact that the country is not a place for foreign aggressors. He said the people of Afghanistan will always fight for their independence. Khatibzadeh stressed that Iran will try its utmost to contribute to the formation of an inclusive government in the country and sustainable peace. Regarding a conflict in the Valley of Panjshir, Iran's official called intra-Afghan political talks the only solution. He noted that the Taliban must act according to international law and respect the rights of the Panjshir's people. U.S. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham says American troops will have to return to Afghanistan in the near future. He made a comment in an interview with the BBC. He said that the return will be made because of a great terror threat in Afghanistan. Graham said that the solution is to help the resistance front in Panjshir to stand against the Taliban. He said that over the years, Daesh will also rise in Afghanistan, creating a fractured country. Graham says that this will threaten the interests of Western countries. U.S. troops pulled out of Afghanistan a week ago after the Taliban took over the country. That ended a 20-year war in that country that killed an estimated 240,000 Afghans. Britain's Armed Forces Minister says that the country is investigating whether or not the chaotic withdrawal of U.S.-led forces from Afghanistan led some war veterans to commit suicide. Now, that followed comments by Junior Defense Minister that some soldiers had taken their own lives in the past week. James Hippie initially cited bad feelings among soldiers over the situation in Afghanistan, but he later wrote back from the comments saying it had been incorrect. Britain lost 457 armed forces personnel since joining the U.S.-led coalition that invaded Afghanistan under the so-called War on Terror in 2001. The Taliban's takeover of the country after the longest and costliest U.S.-led war dismayed the coalition troops. The UK Defence Minister says it has no confirmed suicide cases among British Afghan veterans due to the collapse. A growing number of civil society organizations and rights groups are urging the European Union to take in more Afghan refugees. Our correspondent Jerome Hughes has been gauging the opinions of citizens in Brussels.
Across the world, the Afghan crisis continues to be a major talking point. It's no different here in the EU's de facto capital, Brussels. Members of the public have been sharing their views with Press TV.
I think they should leave the country and try for themselves to come out of it.
We should not intervene sometimes in proposing democracy or the sorts of political situations where they're not in, when the country is not ready.
Especially the United States did in this country. It make it worse, I think.
Now they are taking all of the materials. But I think as a global community, we should interfere, but to stop that.
Power and interference always go together.
Anti-war campaigners are furious at remarks made by EU Foreign Policy Chief Joseph Borrell last Thursday. He said Afghanistan proves the need for an expanded EU military force, more commonly referred to as the EU Army.
We have to step up our integrated approach, combining military, civilian, development and diplomatic efforts.
We have been speaking to citizens about Afghans who are desperate to seek asylum. EU leaders, they don't want more refugees. Do you think we should take more refugees in?
Yes, he needs to take more refugees because these people is in bad situation in their country.
Belgian people or European people say that we don't have enough place, but I think we have.
We must take refugees because all the people are on the same world. We are the same world.
They need to offer that help, and I believe that they need to offer a place to stay because they have nowhere else to stay.
The policy of occupying nations against their will certainly didn't go well in Afghanistan. Top EU officials and also prime ministers in the 27-country bloc are saying lessons must be learned. A good start, critics argue, would be for the EU to stop responding how high when Washington shouts, jump. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Israeli police saying that six Palestinians have escaped from a high-security prison northeast of Al-Quds. They were cellmates and tunneled out of Gilboa prison overnight. Five of the prisoners reportedly belonged to the Islamic Jihad movement, and one was a former commander affiliated with the Fatah party. Israel has mobilized security forces to search for the prisoners, who they believe might try to reach the nearby West Bank. The Fatah movement already hailed the prisoners' move, calling it a slap in the face of the Israeli regime and its military. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has also called it a heroic act and a great defiance of the Israeli security system. Abona Kandil says that Israel has launched a major operation to find the escaped Palestinian inmates by deploying the military to the region.
Extensive manhunt is underway after six Palestinian prisoners succeeded to escape from the Gilboa prison. Large numbers of Israeli police, Israeli military had been pulled to the area. The checkpoints had been set all over the occupied West Bank, mainly in northern the occupied West Bank, in search for those six Palestinian prisoners. The Israeli police stormed the Gilboa prison, and they would be sending those 400 Palestinian prisoners to other Israeli jails to conduct investigation.
In Lebanon, people have held a commemoration ceremony for deceased head of the Supreme Islamic Shia Council, Sheikh Abdul Amir Kablan. The prominent religious figure passed away on Friday. We're joined by our correspondent in Beirut, Mariam Saleh, an hour ago, and she provided us with some details.
So today we are witnessing a national mourning. We will be having national mourning for 2 days. We had yesterday and today. And tomorrow we will witness the funeral procession of Sheikh Abdul Amir Kablan. We see today figures that are not only Muslim and Shiite, but also we have Christian figures. We have Druze figures. We have figures from all sects in Lebanon, all factions, approximately all the factions in Lebanon have come today to pay their condolences. We had yesterday the leaders of Hezbollah. We had the Deputy Secretary General, Sheikh Naim Qasim, head of the Executive Council for Hezbollah, Sayyid Hashim Safiyuddin. They all came personally to give their pay their condolences, because they also expressed in their statements how significant this figure was, whether it were in the preaching for unity among the Lebanese and also among the Arabs and Muslims, but also in calling and supporting the resistance, whether in Lebanon or in Palestine. Now, Sheikh Qabalan has a very long history of active work in Lebanon and also in Iraq when he was younger. His father and grandfather were all clerics.
The 2018 alleged chemical attack in Douma has turned into a pressure tool by the West against Syria. The U.S., the U.K., and France blamed the Syrian government for the attack and conducted the strikes against the country. And that's while Damascus has time and again said it never carried out that attack. And now the BBC has admitted that its documentary on an alleged 2018 chemical attack in Syria contained serious inaccuracies.
On April 7, 2018, an alleged chemical weapon attack in the city of Douma, Syria, killed at least 50 people. The suspected chemical attack involved two chlorine cylinders dropped from a Syrian Air Force helicopter. Following the incident, the Union of Medical Care and Relief Organizations said that the symptoms of the casualties were consistent with exposure to a nerve agent. Almost a week later, the United States accused the Syrian government of using chemical weapons containing chlorine and the nerve agent sarin to bombard Douma. Syrian President Bashar Assad accused the US, UK, and France of staging the attack in Douma, saying the attack did not take place. He called the whole incident a lie and called on the Western governments to provide evidence for the accusations. Also, after a group of Russian specialists tested Douma's soil samples, Moscow confirmed that the results showed no presence of substances containing chlorine or any sort of nerve agents in Douma. Russia also confirmed that Douma's hospitals had not received any patients with symptoms of exposure to sarin or chlorine. On April 14th, hours before the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons fact-finding mission team arrived in Damascus, the US, UK, and France conducted missile strikes against the Syrian government. Former US President Donald Trump claimed Washington seeks to establish a deterrent against the production, spread, and use of chemical weapons. However, the Syrian Foreign Ministry denounced the attacks as barbaric aggression. Thousands of Syrians have died since the outbreak of the Western-backed war in 2011 to topple President Assad. Western governments, the US in particular, have used different ways, from proxies and direct involvement to crippling economic sanctions, to oust the Syrian government, yet they have failed. Now, the BBC has admitted that its documentary on an alleged 2018 chemical weapon attack in Syria contained serious inaccuracies. The BBC says it had no evidence to back up a claim that a former chemical weapons inspector, in exchange for money, had expressed doubts over the conclusion that the attack was carried out by Damascus. That could justify the reason why war on Syria has continued for this long.
Well, the war on Syria was always based on lies, on complete fabrications, repeated endlessly. They were, from the very beginning, an attempt to pull down, totally dismember Syria. They were part of the U.S. and Western Allied war in the whole region, also against Iraq, the continuing threats on Iran, the destruction of Libya. So Syria was very much a part of this. And the fact that they've absolutely failed in this effort, now, like, you know, a can of worms, the truth begins to sort of ooze out, because they're not willing to continue the war. They see what the U.S. complete defeat in Afghanistan led to. So I think that's why the exposés now. But this was always a lie, and from the beginning, it was very thoroughly debunked.
The have been many other accusations on the use of chemical weapons in Syria. In 2018, Russia said that Britain and its allies were involved in faking a suspected chemical attack in the Syrian town of Douma. Or how about the children who were staged at the center of conflict and tales about the alleged Douma chemical attack? Either way, Daesh terrorists have been accused on several occasions to have deliberately staged the attack as a provocation.
UK's national broadcaster, the BBC, has admitted that its documentary on an alleged 2018 chemical weapon attack in Syrian city of Douma contained serious inaccuracies. The program reported that the former inspector with the International Chemical Weapons Watchdog had expressed doubts over the organization's stance on the incident. The watchdog, in its probe into the incident, had blamed it on the Syrian government, a charge Damascus denied. The BBC program claimed the inspector was motivated to go public about his doubts in return for getting financial reward from the whistleblowing website WikiLeaks. Now, the British Broadcasting Corporation has accepted that it had no evidence to back up that claim. Also, WikiLeaks has said such a reward was never paid.
The excuse of chemical weapons was used in Syria again and again. In 2012, 2013, it was used for the sanctions on Syria. It was used for the U.S. beginning military actions. The latest exposé in Douma in 2018 was at a time when every report said Syria was clearly winning the war. And that was why this massive new level of bombardment, happened. They just found a new story. All of the media used it. Hundreds and hundreds of news articles from every direction screamed about it. And now we find it's just a fabrication.
It's surprisingly rare for the BBC to rule against itself. The recent confession is hailed as a major victory for truth.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Imam Hussein and his followers endured agonizing pain and suffering during Ashura, November 21st, 2012. The pain and suffering which Imam Hussein and his followers endured on the day of Ashura were too agonizing and the harm which was inflicted was very serious. The life of Hussein ibn Ali is more valuable than everything in the world. The pure and sacred lives of those followers of Imam Hussein, the lives of those youth and those members of Imam Hussein's household are not comparable to the life of other people. Their bodies were covered in blood and dirt. They made sacrifices and they laid down their lives. The households of the Holy Prophet and Imam Ali were imprisoned. Those events are very tragic and very difficult to tolerate. But what was achieved on the day of Ashura was so great and glorious that it made it easy for Imam Hussein and his followers and his household to endure the sufferings. This has been narrated by prominent figures. Imam Hussein sustained the path of the Holy Prophet, November 21st, 2012. The Islamic Ummah should never forget the event of Ashura, which is a lesson and a source of guidance for us. Definitely, Islam is alive because of the event of Ashura and the efforts of Hussein ibn Ali. And I am from Hussein. This narration means that Hussein continued the path of the Holy Prophet, and he continued to promote Islam after him. If it had not been for the event of Ashura, and if these great sacrifices had not been made in the history of Islam, this valuable experience and this practical lesson would not have been bestowed on the Islamic Ummah, and Islam would have definitely deviated from its path, as many religions before Islam did, and nothing would have remained from it. The greatness of Ashura is because of this.
Ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana latshan.
Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, made the army of reason overcome the army of ignorance.
The greatness of Zainab al-Kubra's movement is reflected in her sermon at Kufa's Marketplace, April 21st, 2010. The greatness of Zainab al-Kubra's movement is reflected in what is left of her sermons. Her unforgettable sermon in Kufa's Marketplace was not just an ordinary speech. It was not just the personal opinion of an important figure. Her sermon was a great and beautifully worded analysis of the Islamic community's situation at that time. The sermon included the most profound Islamic concepts. See how strong her character was. Her brother and her imam and leader had been martyred in a desert just 2 days before. Her dear ones, her children, and many other people had been martyred. She and tens of other women and children were taken captive on the same day. They were paraded in different places. Some of the people who were watching them were cheerful and some were shedding tears. Zainab suddenly started her great mission in that critical situation.
Fires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
After the Taliban swept to power in Afghanistan, the world is still evaluating the results of the West's 20-year-long war in the country. The United States have faced criticism over its messy withdrawal from Afghanistan and its achievements in the Central Asian country. The unexpectedly rapid fall of the Afghan capital, the scenes of chaos at the Kabul International Airport where hundreds of people desperate to leave the country had gathered, and the bomb attack claimed by the Daesh terror group that killed over 170 people, including 13 U.S. troops, have all raised questions about the U.S. military superiority. That's an issue British Defense Secretary Ben Wallace raised in an interview with The Spectator magazine.
It's obvious that Britain is not a superpower, but a superpower that is also not prepared to stick at something isn't probably a superpower either. It is certainly not a global force, it's just a big power.
This wasn't the first time that the British Defense Secretary has criticized Washington, a close UK ally. Back in August, he said former US President Donald Trump's decision to clinch a deal with the Taliban was a mistake.
I would say if it's a superpower or not is pretty irrelevant. The United States is still the greatest danger facing the world and the greatest concentration of private power against our species that has ever existed.
While the U.S. threatens military action against nations it deems its adversaries, including Iran, Russia, and China, it appears that more Washington allies are beginning to take up the opinion that America has lost its superpower status.
Good afternoon.
Earlier this year, U.S. President Joe Biden announced the August 31st deadline for the withdrawal of American troops from Afghanistan as a means to uphold the 2020 deal reached between former President Donald Trump's administration and the Taliban in the Qatari capital, Doha. But the withdrawal of American forces from the country meant that all U.S. allies had to follow suit, regardless of whether they intended to do so, as they depended on U.S. logistics and air support, as well as a safe evacuation of their citizens. The developments in recent weeks have reignited the debate about the formation of a European Rapid Response Force.
And I think it's clear that the need for more European defense has never been as much as evident as today after the events in Afghanistan. Sometimes something happens that pushes the history. It creates a breakthrough. And I think that the Afghanistan events of this summer is one of these cases.
The EU has been working on that. It was positioned for us, 4 years ago as, well, Trump is an unreliable ally. See what he's doing. He's driving the Europeans to do this. But as a matter of fact, that project was under construction before Trump.
In an interview earlier this year, German Defense Minister Annegret Kramp-Karrenbauer questioned the bloc's strategic autonomy from the United States. Her comments drew fierce criticism from French President Emmanuel Macron, who believes in the bloc's so-called strategic autonomy.
You know, Europe, with its colonial history, it's certainly, not good news to find out that they're building a new army of their own again, because that has never meant anything good for the people in the rest of the world. But the fact that there is maybe another challenger being lifted up and presented to Washington, that's, I think, a healthy development.
But the question now is what it will take for the European U.S. allies to turn their ideas into action and seek independence from Washington.
Venezuela's main opposition parties have announced an end to 3 years of boycotting elections. The country's opposition alliance, the so-called Democratic Unity Roundtable, which is led by the U.S.-sponsored opposition figure Juan Guaido, announced on Tuesday that it would participate in the regional and municipal elections scheduled for November 21. President Nicolas Maduro has praised the move as worthy of applause for returning to democracy. The opposition, however, said its participation would not mean that it believed the elections would be free or fair. The alliance boycotted the 2018 presidential vote, which Maduro won, and the 2020 legislative elections, in which the opposition lost control of Congress. In both cases, it dismissed the elections as fraudulent. Its decision to end the boycott comes as government and opposition representatives are involved in talks, mediated by Norway and hosted by Mexico. The talks, which began last month, are aimed at resolving the political crisis that plagued the Latin American country after Guaido unilaterally declared himself interim president in January 2019. Back in 2019, Guaido proclaimed himself the interim president of Venezuela. Back then, the administration of former President Donald Trump, along with several European countries and a number of right-wing Latin American leaders, recognized Guaido as Venezuela's interim president. The U.S. confiscated Venezuelan state assets in America in a bid to support Guaido.
They were doing things that really were undermining the autonomy and the sovereignty of Venezuela to have its own free and fair elections, and were committing acts which they had no right under any sort of international law to do, and so it just is a matter of it's a matter of time before the failure of all these events catches up to the United States and the Venezuelan opposition who it was working with.
The U.S. move was seen as an attempt to topple the legitimate government of Venezuela. That was not the first time the U.S. pushed for regime change in Venezuela. Back in 2002, during the presidency of George W. Bush, a coup was orchestrated against Venezuela's former president, Hugo Chavez. The plot failed due to overwhelming popular support and mobilization against the coup. Washington has a long list of military interventions and coups in different Latin American countries. Venezuela is now one of the few countries in that region which is led by a left-wing anti-imperialist government. The U.S. push to oust Maduro's government is reminiscent of U.S. colonial moves in Latin America during the 20th century. The Food Assistance Agency of the UN has estimated that one out of every three Venezuelan is struggling to consume enough daily calories.
The United States has fully withdrawn its forces from Afghanistan to officially end 20 years of occupation. The invasion will be remembered for its colossal failures, unfulfilled promises, and a frantic final exit that cost the lives of scores of Afghan civilians and 13 U.S. military personnel. The final U.S. evacuation flight left Kabul Airport late on Monday. U.S. military officials say hundreds of Americans who have been left on Afghan soil will be transported out of the country in the coming days. A Taliban spokesman says the defeat of the United States in Afghanistan was a lesson for the invaders.
The withdrawal of foreign forces is a big achievement for the Afghans and their independence. It is the day of good lesson for the aggressors that they shouldn't have invaded Afghanistan.
More than 122,000 people have reportedly been evacuated from Kabul since August the 14th, the day before the Taliban took control of the country. U.S. President Joe Biden has come under immense criticism of his handling of the withdrawal. Nearly 90 retired U.S. generals and admirals have called for Pentagon Chief Lloyd Austin and Joint Chiefs Chairman General Mark Milley to resign for their roles surrounding the chaotic pullout. The retired flag officers proposed what they felt should have happened in the withdrawal, including not rushing the pullout and not abandoning the Bagram Air Base and American weapons and military equipment in the hands of the Taliban.
The war in Afghanistan is now over. I'm the fourth president who has faced the issue of whether and when to end this war. When I was running for president, I made a commitment to the American people that I would end this war. Today, I've honored that commitment. It was time to be honest with the American people again.
Well, I don't believe the U.S. government has learned a lesson. The U.S. media certainly hasn't learned a lesson. Statements we've seen from Biden, for instance, have been that we've accomplished our goals in Afghanistan, which I think is furthest from the truth.
The U.S. invaded Afghanistan in 2001 following the 9/11 attacks under the pretext of so-called war on terror. According to estimates, America's longest war took the lives of nearly 2,500 U.S. troops and an estimated 240,000 Afghans, and cost around $2 trillion U.S. dollars. Thousands of Afghan civilians were also maimed during the years. The estimated interest costs of the war are expected to top $6.5 trillion by 2050.
I think the U.S. went in there 20 years ago, removed the Taliban, and now the Taliban is back, perhaps stronger than ever. It seems like it's an utter defeat for the United States.
The war has left Afghanistan in ruins and devastated the country's infrastructure. Just as Saigon marked the humiliating defeat of U.S. geostrategic ambitions in Indochina after 10 years of war and conflict in Vietnam, many analysts now believe Kabul marks the same humiliating defeat in Central Asia.
You know, after the Vietnam War, there was something they called the Vietnam Syndrome. The American people didn't want to go into that kind of war ever again. And I believe we're seeing the beginning of an Afghan syndrome. The American people think it was a mistake, don't want to see it again. The trillions of dollars that went into Afghanistan could have been used to help the Afghani people or for the American people.
The botched military occupation is likely to trigger a refugee crisis in the Middle East and beyond. When it comes to Afghanistan and the wider region, Washington and its allies have proved after two decades that they have nothing to offer but misery and despair. U.S. officials believed that a U.S.-trained, funded, and equipped Afghan army could hold the line against the poorly trained, funded, and equipped Taliban insurgency. But after a 20-year presence in Afghanistan, they still had little or no understanding of Afghan society and the power of Taliban militants.
Hundreds of Palestinians have staged protests against the Israeli regime's inhumane blockade of the Gaza Strip, burning tires and hurling explosive devices toward the fence between Gaza and the occupied territories for several consecutive nights. The Israeli military, which deployed additional troops along the fence ahead of the night protests, used live fire, tear gas, and stun grenades against Palestinian protesters. Several Palestinians have been injured by Israeli forces east of the Gaza Strip. The Palestinian Health Ministry's spokesman, Ashraf Al-Kedra, said several others were hurt from tear gas canisters fired at them. During Saturday night's protests alone, 11 Palestinians were injured by live fire and other aggressive measures used by Israeli forces.
I mean, it's because the laws are not being implemented, they're not being penalized, they're not being punished for all these, violations of all these laws. So they feel like they have a green light to commit more crimes and more crimes. And this becomes a natural system for the Zionists. The Zionists now, they think that they're above the law and no law is going to, stop them from committing any crime that they want to do. And that's why you can see that whenever we hear condemnations from countries or even the nations assemblies, there's nothing really coming out of it at the end of the day.
Gazans have been organizing protests since last week. They are demanding that the crossings be reopened to facilitate the entry of goods and humanitarian aid. In a statement on Sunday, the resistance committees in Palestine announced that the protests will continue until the Israeli regime lifts its siege. The Palestinians say the Israeli regime's repeated attacks on the positions of the resistance in Gaza would not dissuade them from fighting for their freedom and dignity. Over the Israeli regime's tight blockade, which now includes deliberate hampering of efforts to reconstruct the strip following its latest war on Gaza. Back in May, the Israeli military bombarded the besieged Gaza Strip for 11 consecutive days, killing at least 260 Palestinians, including 66 children. The Gaza-based resistance groups fired around 4,000 rockets towards the Israeli-occupied territories during the 11-day war, forcing Tel Aviv to call for a ceasefire.
The only way it really works with this particular regime, and this illegitimate regime, the Zionist regime, is by righteous, unified resistance. And that's exactly what we want to see in Palestine.
Amid the ongoing confrontations, Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas and Israeli Minister for Military Affairs Benny Gantz met in Ramallah on Sunday, marking the highest level meeting held between the two sides in over a decade. The two discussed issues related to diplomacy, economics, and civil affairs, according to a statement from Gantz's office.
You know, it's quite clear that the Zionist regime does not want peace and does not want to recognize the Palestinians, because they had a chance many times. You can see that they're still stealing, you know, areas in the West Bank, and that's obviously international law breaches. We can see now, you know, Sheikh Jarrah, Sinwan, all these different areas, even in Jerusalem, in different areas, they're still, you know, evicting, stealing people's homes in a very, very barbaric way.
The Palestinian resistance groups have pledged not to allow the Israeli regime to continue its aggression against the Palestinian people or change the rules of engagement.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth. Dear brothers and sisters, you are listening to The Spring of Truth from IRIB English Radio. In this special episode, we select a short part of Imam Khomeini's will. Selfish people and oppressors exploited the Holy Quran, introduced deviation from the religion of God and the divine book and tradition. The Holy Quran, the book which was descended as the complete and the seal of revelation to the Prophet Muhammad in order to enhance the people of the world, to establish justice and equity, and to entrust governance to men of Allah, the infallibles, from the first to the last, so that they would entrust it to whomever served the interest of humanity, was removed from the scene to the extent that it seems it never had any role to play to guiding humanity.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitan rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And you are listening to Spring of Truth coming to you from IRIB English Radio. So stay tuned with us. I am your host, Abdullah Al-Musawi, an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qom. We are looking at Imam Khomeini's point of view when it comes to Ashura. Imam Khomeini was quoted saying, "Lamentation for the martyrs means the preservation and perpetuation of the movement. The Shia, when they show condolences and renew this bereavement, they also learn great lessons from it. When we cry for Imam Hussein and when we lament for him, it's not a matter of just us crying. It's there are more lessons to be derived. From Karbala, we learn to stand against oppression, to join justice, to be courageous, to stand for freedom, to speak our thoughts, to bring our morals to the outside, to enjoin good, to forbid evil, to stand with the truth, to sacrifice ourselves for the truth itself, and so many lessons to be learned and derived. So crying for Imam al-Hussein salamullah alayhi is not a matter of just me shedding tears. As in fact, there is a huge love that I have for the Imam that drives me towards these beautiful meanings and these beautiful moral traits that the Imam himself fought for and stood for. Yes, it begins as an emotional outcry for the Imam himself. But that outcry itself, not only for the Imam, salamullah alayhi, but in fact for everything that he stood for. Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum, Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum, Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum, Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum. Some people might mistake that cry for weakness, mistake that cry for hopelessness. But in fact, throughout this cry that we do for Imam Hussein, throughout this lamentation that we do for Imam Hussein, salamullah alayhi, is what we show that we are learning, we are moving in the path of Imam Hussein, salamullah alayhi. When my heart is active, when my heart is emotional, when my heart is raging with the love of Hussein, then I don't care if I give my own blood, my own family, for the sake of Islam and for the sake of the truth. If you look at all the leaders, all the martyrs, when they go to war, they say, Ya Hussein. Not because they are just weak and they're just crying for Imam Hussein. No, no, because these tears that they shed, this love that they had, it drove them to defend their own families, to defend their own land. So Imam Khomeini says, the crying and lamentation for the martyrs is actually the continuation of the movement of Imam al-Hussein.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Subcontinent.
and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. The program aims to discuss the most significant issues in the subcontinent that affect the governments, communities, organizations, and the region as a whole. And as usual, we will explore and explain its geopolitics, untangle the arguments from different perspectives, and make the alternative voices heard.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we are going to take a look at the new refugee crisis in Afghanistan, triggered by the fall of US-backed government in Kabul and Taliban's lightning-fast takeover. And we shall discuss how the US and its European allies, who engineered this humanitarian catastrophe, are cold-shouldering the desperate Afghan refugees.
Taliban's stunning blitz and the swift collapse of the US-backed government in Kabul has sparked a new refugee crisis in Afghanistan. Tens of thousands of desperate Afghans have been scrambling to flee the country amidst unexplainable chaos and confusion. The latest displacement of Afghans is part of a historical exodus that has continued since the 1970s. However, this time, the crisis was engineered by the US and NATO forces who invaded the country on flimsy pretexts and abandoned it after 20 years with utter haste and recklessness.
For close to 3 weeks, the dilapidated roadways outside Kabul's Hamid Karzai International Airport have been a scene of desperation and chaos. There is gridlock in the besieged city, with panicked people trying to flee, leaving behind their homes, belongings, and dreams. Taliban's stunning takeover and the cowardly retreat by the US-led international forces has left the vulnerable Afghans high and dry. They feel betrayed, dismayed, and exhausted after years of foreign military occupation. Even while fleeing the US-engineered chaos, death has chased them. Some died while trying to cling to a US military plane in the frantic scramble to escape the country, while many others were killed in a series of bombings outside the airport, claimed by the Daesh militant group. The families are still searching the city's morgues for their loved ones. The evacuation effort is becoming increasingly dangerous, with the August 31 deadline for foreign forces to leave already over. Many countries stopped their flights last week, and many others are winding down evacuations this week, including the US and UK. In all, more than 100,000 people, both Afghans and foreign nationals, have reportedly been evacuated in last 3 weeks, with their final destination still unclear. Many European countries have rejected them, and in the US, the issue of Afghan refugees is becoming an instrument for partisan politics.
Most Afghans realize that the road ahead is full of difficulties, with the world becoming less tolerant and more hostile to refugees. Finding a new home after being uprooted from their lands can be a Herculean task, especially when the hosts are unfriendly and unwelcoming. Far from extending warm welcome to the desperate and war-weary Afghans, many countries in the West have issued warnings against asylum seekers and have shut their doors to them. In the US, anti-refugee policies have entered the mainstream political discourse, while Europe seems determined to avoid the repeat of the 2015 refugee crisis.
In the last 1 year, the US has admitted just 11,800 refugees from across the world, which included only 495 Afghans. It's a tiny number compared to roughly 20,000 Afghans on the waiting list. The dramatic turn of events in recent weeks has fully taken the lid off America's deeply flawed asylum policy when it comes to desperate Afghans. It has also exposed the far-right, anti-immigrant attitudes in the country. The resettlement of tens of thousands of Afghans is fast emerging as a volatile political issue in the United States, amid simmering humanitarian crisis at the US-Mexico border and stiff opposition from Republicans. Former US President Donald Trump was aghast at seeing Afghans in a US aircraft, while his former advisor, Stephen Miller, said the influx of Afghan refugees will bring the threat of jihadism to the U.S. On the other hand, European leaders, haunted by the 2015 refugee crisis, seek to avoid another large-scale influx of refugees. French President Emmanuel Macron stressed that Europe alone cannot shoulder the consequences of the situation in Afghanistan, while Germany's future Chancellor Armin Laschet said there must be no repeat of 2015. Greek Minister Notis Mitsotakis said his country won't be the gateway for irregular flows into the EU, while Turkish President Tayyip Erdogan declared that Turkey has no duty, responsibility or obligation to be Europe's refugee warehouse.
Caught in the vicious cycle of violence, Afghan refugees have been reduced to commodities, exploited by both ill-wishers and well-wishers. Reports about the US troops extorting hefty sum of money from poor refugees seeking evacuation at the Kabul airport, EU leaders' proceedings with their widely denounced deportation of Afghan asylum seekers, or Turkish politicians mulling over lucrative deals with the West to stem the flow of Afghan refugees are some classical examples of exploiting the vulnerability of poor, desperate, war-weary, homeless Afghans.
Amidst a mad scramble to clear many layers of security at Kabul's international airport and get on a flight, there were reports of U.S. forces extorting money from Afghan nationals seeking evacuation. Even those with special immigrant visas were turned away. U.S. Marines, who have controlled the only functional airport in Afghanistan for 3 weeks, demanded anything between $500 and $2,000 from desperate Afghan nationals to give them a safe passage.
Well, in such kind of a circumstances, exploitations, extorting, and any kind of situation could be visible. When there is a lawlessness, when there is a chaos, when there is uncertainty, when there is no central control, I think such kind of a situation emerge. And for this, I think the responsibility lies on lied on the Americans and the other troops to take care of the sensitivities of the people and do not go for undermining and exploiting the vulnerabilities of those oppressed and the people who have no hope now, and the people who were promised so much. They must not have been in such kind of a situation.
Those who couldn't afford the money fell into the hands of greedy smugglers who promised to take them to Europe via Turkey. In Turkey, the growing anti-migrant sentiment has prompted the government to fortify the eastern border with Iran. Turkish President Tayyip Erdogan has threatened to send Afghan refugees to Europe, where they are unwelcome.
This is my request to Turkey government. Please don't beat us. We are not terrorists. We are not terrorists in your countries. We will not fight your civilians. We will never be thieved here. We will never rob here. We are Muslims like you, and we want peace.
Opposition leaders have proposed a deal with Europe to block their passage to Europe in return for money, similar to Turkey's 2016 contract with the European Union. This clearly illustrates how the Afghan refugee crisis has been commodified. Meanwhile, six European Union countries have vowed to continue deporting Afghan migrants in utter disregard of the unfolding situation in Afghanistan. This year, about 1,200 Afghans were deported from Europe, despite pleas by the Afghan government to halt deportations.
Now, the huge responsibility lies on the Western partners of Afghanistan by accepting these migrants and giving them a fair share of life in the host countries. And for this, there should be a global summit where all countries need to take care of the needs and of all the migrants and all these people who are refugees. They should get some good status where they should forget the miseries of their lives.
While Western countries who invaded occupied, and destroyed Afghanistan in the last 20 years continue to be indifferent to the plight of desperate and homeless Afghan refugees, countries in the region have again stepped up to bear the burden of US-imposed war in Afghanistan. Iran and Pakistan, home to more than 6 million documented and undocumented Afghan refugees, have again opened their doors to people displaced by the recent events in the neighboring country. The two countries have pledged coordination in dealing with the